Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The role of philanthropy in society has come under scrutiny during the pandemic as the gulf expanded between the super rich and the poor. The richest man in the world has been lauded for his largesse by some and panned by others who say that Jeff Bezos, who is worth more than $209 billion, gives away just a pittance of his overall wealth. But philanthropic giving in general has grown. The Columbus Foundation set a record for charitable giving in 2020, doling out more than $230 million to more than 4,500 organizations. Angela Parsons is the Vice President for Donor Services and Development for the Columbus Foundation. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks for having me.
And congratulations on the record amount of giving in 2020. It feels good, right?
It does. It feels wonderful.
You know, I was wondering how the foundation has responded to this record amount of giving, you know, because you're getting it from somewhere, right?
So, yes, I think the amazing thing is that it's our current donors that really stepped up, especially during the pandemic, during 2020, during the, you know, social unrest. Our donors have stepped up and put their money where their passions are.
The Dispatch article that I read said that several COVID-19 related initiatives helped. Can you talk about those initiatives and how they spoke to people?
Sure, of course. So we did three main initiatives. One was just our emergency response fund that really helped many, many organizations pivot during COVID. Many organizations needed PPP, you know, PPE. They needed the, you know, money to be able to turn to virtual. They needed just those dollars that were available and give them the flexibility to really be able to serve their clients during this time. The second fund we started was the Emergency Response Fund Digital Equity Fund. And that was specifically in response to the disproportionate digital availability in our communities. And then the final one was the Digital Response Fund for Youth, which is really, as we've seen, the increased violence in our youth, in our community, was a way to hopefully step up and give kids an opportunity to find outlets that are safe and healthy.
We always hear about the amazing amount of giving when there's a crisis. And of course, a lot of it comes from wealthy people, but a lot of it comes from, like, our votes, right? Comes from everyday people that give larger proportions of their income away.
Definitely. Oh, definitely. In 2020, just as an example, our gifts ranged from $2 to $27 million. With the vast majority of those being on that smaller end.
Well, I know you're not probably like talking to the $2 giver necessarily. I know you're probably talking with, but I'm wondering how the conversation differs between the smaller givers and the big ones.
You know, the thing is, it doesn't really differ. People are generous and they give what they can give, and they're passionate about making a difference. And so it's great to talk with any donor, whether it is a donor that's trying to make a $20, you know, credit card gift or is trying to make a $20,000 gift of appreciated securities.
What is right? So legacy type things. Yeah. And I don't know how long you've been in the business, but I'm wondering if there's been a trend over time of people giving and what you've learned about how they, you know, how they think about it.
Yeah. So I've been at the foundation 14 years. I am an estate planning business and tax attorney by education. So I've been around it for over 20 years. And I'd say from a trend perspective, it's really hard because everybody's different. So everybody gives the way that they want to give. Some give based on analytics. You know, they look at the research and that's how they give. Others give because of their passions. Others give because they were helped. You know, is there any one way or one reason people give? No. But I think everyone I've met in the industry wants to do something to help others.
We hear a lot about people who give and it saves them in their taxes and that kind of a thing. And since that's your stock and trade, I mean, how much of that is really part of the conversation?
It's such a small part of the conversation. It's definitely there, right? People probably give more because they think, okay, well, I'm either going to pay it in taxes or I will give it to charity. Especially these last 2 years with the ability to give up to 100% of your adjusted gross income to charity. I've worked with a few donors that are giving up to 100% of their adjusted gross income to charity. So, you know, taxes do play a role, but that's a very small percentage. They have to be philanthropic, right? They are still giving something away. So, you know, taxes, while I think they are important, they are definitely just a small part of it.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about philanthropy today, what the trends are, and why the conversation is coming around to people giving away more of their wealth before they die, and how that's changing the trajectory as the baby boomers move on and the next generations come up. We're talking about $70 trillion between the generation, among baby boomers right now that in wealth, and it's kind of astounding. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest right now is Angela Parsons. She's Vice President for Donor Services and Development for the Columbus Foundation. I wanted to talk about analytics and people who look at the analytics. Do you mean where they figure out, you know, they study where money's needed, or what do you mean by that?
Well, some really do study where money's needed, but most, it's more about what they see or what they've experienced as the needs. You know, for example, our donors, you know, Al and Barb Seamer, you know, Barb was a teacher. She saw the, you know, need for students to have stability, to stay in the school. Transferring schools in the middle of years puts students behind. And because of that, they put their money into the Seamer Family Institute, which is all about family stability and putting those dollars into the communities to keep families stable. So that's, you know, certainly one example of, you know, a lot of knowledge and research going into making those decisions.
And they've created a lot of parameters around which or within Correct. Which the money should be spent. And they're Correct. Heavily involved in that, or at least they were at the outset.
Correct.
And yeah. then something like the Columbus Foundation, you're charged with as caretaker of that.
As caretaker of the dollars, as assistance as needed. You know, they're up and running a lot on their own, but we still help receive the gifts for the institute at the foundation.
And then passions, how does that differ from analytics? Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So we have donors who have all different passions, you know, so we have donors who they're going to leave the majority of their estates to animals and animal welfare. We have other donors who've supported the arts. You know, so it's not necessarily as much about the analytics and the needs as much as it is about their passions and what, you know, where they want their dollars to make a difference in the future.
I mean, how often is it you come across someone who says, I want to get rid of the money, I don't need it, but I don't know how to decide what to do with it?
Quite often. A lot of people have some idea of what they want to support. But that's where we get to, you know, come in and explain all the various options they have. And at the foundation, we have a lot of flexibility to work with donors and to figure out where those passions of theirs are, where the needs are, to explain where the needs in the community are, and how, you know, if they don't have any specific organizations or areas that they're very passionate about, what about just leaving it to the community as a whole to be able to support the greatest needs and opportunities?
So sort of like the foundation's general fund? Is that kind of what it is?
Yeah. Well, it's their own fund. So every donor has their own named fund. Okay. But yes, it's then you know, what we would consider unrestricted or our greatest needs.
And then people who were helped in the past, I guess that's the one that has the best stories.
Yep, definitely. And a lot of those are scholarships. That's one of, you know, one place for sure where a lot of folks who were able to be helped to get their education want to step in and help the next generation make sure they get their education as well.
As far as people, we're talking about increasing amounts of wealth. Now we're talking about trillionaires, you know, billionaires out there within families, I mean, Jeff Bezos alone. We hear about the Sackler family a lot lately. You know, these kinds of wild, crazy numbers are in the news. Is that trickling down to foundations like the Columbus Foundation in general? I mean, is the wealth finding its way to the needs?
Yes, I definitely think it is finding its way to the needs. We work with many families, multi-generational families, where they're sharing the wealth. They're starting to put the wealth aside, letting the next generation be able to advise and make the grants and make the decisions as to where that grant making goes.
Yeah, and I wondered about that because the rest, you know, a lot of us were raised with the likes of, you know, Dallas and, you know, all these ridiculous shows that show people fighting over money a lot. And I think that's probably a real thing in some families. How do you manage that, the expectations of the next generation?
I think it's making sure that everyone's sitting around the table and having the conversation, right? Making sure that the parents are listening to the kids and to listen to their passions. It's about helping them set up a way for the next generation to bring their ideas forward and the reasons why they're important, to help them maybe do that research as to which organizations, you know, might be doing the best work in certain areas so that they can, you know, step up and be at the table and have their say within the family.
What are the most common concerns of people that come to you starting out in this process? What are they worried about? What are their questions?
So many want to teach the next generation. They want to bring the family in and they're not sure how to do it. And I think the biggest thing we see is that the kids see it as the parents' money. And so how do we get the parents to let go of enough control so that it's not just the parents' charitable dollars, it is the charitable dollars for that next generation. So it's really working through giving up some of that control, even though, I mean, it's already been set aside for charity, so they don't have the ability to take it back, but how do they give up the control to the next generation to start making those decisions?
And you think that's just a healthy way to approach the process?
Correct.
Right.
Yep. And to your point of seeing families fight, right? Very rarely do I ever see families fight as they're trying to give away money to charity.
That's good to know in real life. Do you think this increased amount of giving would have happened without the pandemic, or is there always going to be another crisis around the corner and it's just part of the larger, you know, dynamic? Or paradigm, I guess.
I do think it's part of the larger paradigm. I think philanthropy is something we've seen in our, you know, history of the U.S. We've seen it, you know, in the very large foundations, the Ford Foundation, right, in the creation of our libraries. So I think it's something that Americans are aware of. They're very, you know, in tune to, and I think everybody wants to be able to step up and give in whatever way they can, whether it's, you know, time, talent, or treasure. You see it in all communities. So I think the pandemic just raised up a lot of issues and, you know, got people saying, okay, this is where the money's needed now. Whereas, you know, those don't come around quite as often. So with the storms and everything, we're seeing it in, you know, the relief from the hurricanes and now the tropical storms.
Yeah. And another one's upon us. Well, Angela Parsons, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on.
You bet. Angela Parsons is Vice President for Donor Services and Development for the Columbus Foundation. It announced recently a record $231.3 million in giving in 2020. We have more talking about the art of philanthropy, the process of it, how this massive wealth of the baby boomer generation will pass on to the next generation and then pass on into society by way of philanthropy. If you have a question or comment, if you've given away a lot of money and want to talk about what your process was and how you thought about it, or if you're thinking about it and have questions, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When you think of the traditional large-scale philanthropy in the U.S., it's easy to recall the likes of Andrew Carnegie or the Rockefellers. They left behind libraries and museums, edifices, stuff. A new generation of billionaires are taking their philanthropy to another level by pledging to give away their wealth, much of it before they die, to causes. And to do that, they need help. Stephanie Brabi is the founder of Good Ancestor Movement Limited. It's a UK-based wealth advisory firm devoted to wealth minimization. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Did I pronounce your last name correctly?
You did.
Okay.
Thank you.
And so this idea, we think of someone like you, at a wealth advisory firm devoted to wealth accumulation, and you're devoted to wealth minimization. Tell us about that.
That's right. I mean, I spent a decade as a private wealth lawyer in the City of London, supporting individuals and their families with private wealth advice. And that typically was oriented towards wealth accumulation and certainly preservation. But I suppose over a number of years, I was slowly politicized into understanding the root causes of wealth inequality and becoming conscious of the fact that although philanthropy has its benefits, it certainly won't save us. And so the Good Ancestor Movement really exists to disrupt the mainstream wealth advisory industry by challenging ideas around excessive wealth accumulation and tax minimization, by supporting the world's most progressive wealth holders to play their part in contributing to a more equitable society and an economy by minimizing their wealth and pursuing radical wealth redistribution.
So this is not just about how to give money away, but it's how to quit trying to dodge taxes.
Yeah, it's a combination of, it's really about enabling people to take a step back and to zoom out. I talk a lot about decentering philanthropy because it's really important to take a step back and understand the global economy, understand its history and how we inherited the global economy that we have today, and to understand our role as actors in the global economy. We all have an impact in the economy through our behaviors and norms and habits. And it's really important to understand those, and particularly so with ultra wealthy individuals. They need to really examine what they're doing and what their wealth is doing in the world. And so it's not just about giving money away, it's about stewarding your wealth in a way that's responsible.
What do you mean? What about the history? What in the history informs you and informs them?
Well, I suppose a lot of, very wealthy people that come from developed countries in the global north are typically from countries that colonized other countries, typically in the global south, and were able to amass great amounts of wealth through extracting natural resources and exploiting individuals, and that has contributed to vast disparity and wealth inequality, and also ecological collapse really that we're heading for, and so it's really important to understand the full picture and that our, we've built up our wealth as nations through extracting from the land, from a planet that has finite boundaries, and also through exploiting bodies. You know, slavery is still an issue today. Mm-hmm. It may not look exactly the same as it did 400 years ago, but it still exists. We have massive problems with shareholder primacy and a kind of exploitative labor practices. If you're someone that's running a business in that way, you're extracting resources from the earth in a way that's unsustainable, you're putting people on what we have in the UK, 0-hour contracts, and not paying them a wage that they can live on, but you're doing lots of great philanthropy, which I'm sure is doing wonderful things for people in different countries or in their own country, but the kind of net impact of that isn't great. And so we're really helping people to integrate their values into their wealth stewardship as well as their wealth redistribution.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about wealth minimization among the very wealthy in around the world. My guest is Stephanie Brabe. She's founder of Good Ancestor Movement Limited. That's a UK-based wealth advisory firm devoted to wealth minimization. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I wanted to talk to you about shareholder primacy for a second. That's a phrase you just used. That's where decisions are made about a company based on the return to the shareholders versus the return to society.
Yes, it's centering the interest of it's saying that the focal point and the purpose of the company is to maximize shareholder profit, and so that focuses all the attention on what the business can do, what the board can do to generate financial returns, maximum financial returns for the shareholders.
At some cost, probably to someone or something else.
Yes, without having regard to other stakeholders, and so there is this kind of evolving move towards a more stakeholder-based form of capitalism, I suppose, and running companies. But ultimately, these businesses are operating in a way that is unsustainable. Often, having regard to our the environment and climate change and our ecological situation, but also from a social perspective, focusing on shareholder primacy it typically tends to exclude certain people from benefiting, workers primarily from benefiting from the profits of the company.
When you started this venture, what were your expectations about who would be interested in talking to you?
I anticipated that people from across the spectrum, from the wealth advisory industry, from kind of various philanthropic communities and the business communities would want to talk to me. What they would have to say,
okay.
I'm sure is very mixed. I anticipate that there will be a lot of pushback because we think that tax is very important. That's one of the main things that we advocate for is, progressive tax reform and supporting people to adopt a more positive relationship to taxation, to emphasize that it's really a privilege to be able to pay tax or to pay into the public system and to benefit from kind of civic services and public expenditure so that our kids can get educated. And in the UK, we're able to have free healthcare at the point of use. That's a real privilege. And so I anticipate a lot of pushback from people in the advisory sector, in the advisory industry. But there's also, I've been kind of delighted to find that there's a lot of allies in that space as well, and people that with whom the message resonates.
And so there are probably a lot of wealth advisors out there that are somewhere along a continuum then. They're not all in like you to minimize wealth per se, but they get it and they in their way talk about these issues as well.
Yes, I think there's a lot more advisors that with whom this message resonates than one would expect. And I think, it's important to separate the individual advisors from the system, from the industry. And the industry, as you know, has been, you know, set up to preserve and accumulate wealth excessively. And it, I suppose it, you know, it benefits from that, being able to charge for its services in maintaining various structures which are set up to accumulate wealth and minimize taxes. But there are individuals within the industry who, you know, are, even if they don't, even if it doesn't completely align with their values, they're starting to recognize that there is, in fact, a spectrum that they need to be mindful of, not least because their future clients are likely to really support this message. I'm not sure if you're aware of that the Great Wealth Transfer, which is the largest intergenerational wealth transfer in human history, which is happening over the next couple of decades.
Right.
And certainly the combination of that and the pandemic and the climate emergency that we face, people are starting to wake up and realize that continuing to accumulate wealth excessively is just is unsustainable, really.
This is that $70 trillion that will transfer from the baby boomers to the next generation and or causes or tax coffers.
That's right. There's a lot of different numbers flying around, but the one I see most consistently is something around $68 trillion US dollars globally changing hands between boomers and millennials.
What about the kinds of clients that you've attracted? What's surprised you about who's interested in what you're doing?
I suppose, you know, talking about this stuff in theory, it's very easy for people to get excited about, you know, the values that surround this and, you know, talking about these ideas of a more equitable society. But when it comes down to it, in practice, I think I have been surprised to come into contact with people that, who have lived, you know, an entire life of privilege that, you know, have been sort of set up for life, really, and that really care about this stuff and really have strong personal and political views around wealth inequality and, you know, are willing to challenge their families and, you know, navigate quite difficult conversations in order to really live within their values and talk about decreasing wealth or imposing a sort of maximum wealth cap on themselves in a world that where we've been socialized to believe that, you know, you can just keep accumulating, you can just keep getting more and more and more. It really takes some strength and commitment and resilience to navigate that mindset and to commit to changing it and you know, backing it up with consistent action. So that's really surprised me.
Is there still, and I don't know about the UK, although I was lucky enough when I was sick there to get some great health care very easily. It was really nice. But in terms of just, you know, in the United States, there's so much value associated with things and edifices. So people donate money to build a building or a hospital or a this or a that, and they get their name put on it. Is that a thing in the UK? And what about that that dynamic, you know, that paradigm and how people are just attached to making sure everybody knows where the money comes from? Because once you give it to taxes, you don't get credit for it in the public domain.
Yes, that's a big part of philanthropy. And I think there are nuances in our respective cultures. You know, I think we're from probably less people kind of making grander gestures for, you know, the wing of a hospital or, you know, an art, a gallery within a large museum or something. But it does manifest in different ways. I think there is, you know, a naturally kind of a human tendency to be led by ego and to be led by, you know, how we want to be remembered. And, you know, one of the reasons why we're called the Good Ancestor Movement is really because I wanted to capture a way of talking about legacy. And, you know, I think we're probably all inclined to try and curate our own legacies in a way that, you know, that we want to be remembered. But actually, the, you know, the planet and future generations will judge what our legacy is. And I think that's framed very beautifully through the concept of being a good ancestor. So to answer your question, I don't think it's as prevalent here in the UK, but there certainly is that that resistance to sort of losing control over where, you know, where the money goes once it's been paid in taxes.
So I was talking to a philanthropist who donated money to a building, and they didn't really care if their name went on anything, but the organization, you know, that benefited from their largesse really wanted to give them that credit. They really wanted to show their thanks by naming something after them. At least that was the you know, the kind of thing I heard. I mean, it kind of cuts both ways, right? I mean, that it's not just about personal aggrandizement, but also credit and thanks.
Yeah, no, I think it's about what you're trying to achieve. If you're a philanthropist that wants to do some good things and you know, donate some great causes, and you know, you're quite happy to stop there. I mean, sure, it's, you know, it's lovely to say thank you. It's lovely to have your name on a plaque. But if your main driver for pursuing wealth redistribution is to establish equity in the economy and to rebuild our ecological foundations and you know, to see an end to racial justice and to see social equity, then, you know, I think your objectives are different, and I suppose it's not something that you would expect to necessarily to be recognized, but more a sort of moral imperative and a standard by which you judge yourself.
I know I have to let you go pretty soon. I wanted to ask you how often people say, I don't trust the government to spend the money right. There's a whole anti-government thing going on. We're very polarized over it in the United States, at least. And I noticed to a certain extent, obviously, in the UK. How much does that come into the conversation? Well, yeah, you know, as far as, you know, minimizing wealth by way of more taxes.
Maybe every other conversation. and if it doesn't come out directly, there's an indirect resistance. People can't, you know, a lot of people can't seem to distinguish between, you know, paying taxes, not being, you know, paying directly into the pockets of Mr. Johnson, but rather into the public purse. And I would like to see a shift in how we see taxes, kind of a more, you know, a vertical responsibility. I want us to talk about it as a collective responsibility that we owe to each other. And, you know, to my hope is that we'll be able to build a wave of momentum around sort of the importance of civic consciousness and civic responsibility and engagement, rather than thinking about individual politicians and party politics.
And I think maybe people just listening or just jumping in right now and hearing you talk are making some assumptions about what your clientele is made up of. Can you give us a thumbnail of kind of who comes to you? And is it just young people? Is it just super wealthy? Is it middle income? I mean, what is it?
It's a mixture. I would say in terms of wealth, they're typically within the definition of ultra high net worth individual. So in the UK, that's about £25 million plus. They tend to be very thoughtful, very kind of modest, and, you know, quite frugal, socially conscious. I mean, we're actually starting our educational program this evening with a group of 7 wealth holders, and I think the majority of them are vegetarian or vegan. Okay. So that gives you some sense of their, you know, their personal values and choices. I would say the message sort of, you know, the movement particularly resonates with people in their 20s and 30s, but we're certainly having contact with people in their 40s and 50s as well. So, you know, although there is a slight bias towards the millennial generation, there's also, you know, older people that are attracted to us and find their way to us.
I mean, there might be a bias toward the millennial generation, but there isn't the wealth there yet, right?
Well, I mean, some of them do have direct access. It, you know, very much depends on, you know, individual circumstances. Okay. Some people are, you know, beneficiaries of trusts. Other people are, you know, have no direct access at all and are awaiting a liquidity event either during their, you know, parents' lifetimes or, you know, awaiting inheritance. So we can meet people at different engagement points depending on their circumstances.
Stephanie Brabe, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Anne.
Stephanie Brabi is founder of Good Ancestor Movement Limited. That's a UK-based wealth advisory firm devoted to wealth minimization. Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation about the issue of wealth minimization, about the issue of accumulation of wealth, and how it can be offset for the better good. So if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Americans born between 1946 and 1964 have accumulated some $70 trillion American dollars over the last six decades, and now it's time to give it away. That is, hand it down or hand it over. In fact, the transfer of wealth has already begun. Some, including billionaire Warren Buffett, have pledged to give much of their wealth away to address societal problems. We're talking about what that could mean on a larger scale in addressing global issues. Chuck Collins is director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good. It's a progressive multi-issue think tank. His 2021 book is titled The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. He wrote about the process of letting go of wealth for the fall 2021 edition of Yes Magazine. We'll post a link to that at WOSU.org/allsides. Chuck Collins, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, giving away a great amount of wealth in theory is a noble practice. Do you know if there's any resistance among the wealthy, especially those who work for them, like the tax attorneys and the wealth advisors? We obviously just talked to somebody from the UK who is not and has actually changed her career trajectory. But all things being equal, what do you hear?
Well, I think the overall dynamic is there's a very large, what I would call the wealth defense industry. These are the tax planners, advisors, wealth managers who have that bias toward accumulating more wealth, passing it on, building dynastic wealth over generations. And that's the process where I met your previous guest, Steph Brobi, because she's one of the wonderful exceptions to that. I could listen to her for hours. She's just got a really compelling case for as a wealth advisor, to raise some different questions for her clients and encourage them to think beyond accumulation and beyond just passing it on to children.
Well, I guess when you think about percentages, it's not the percentage isn't there for a wealth advisor to minimize wealth. So it has to come from something different than just their pocketbook.
True. Yeah. I think, as I say, the wealth advisors make millions by hiding trillions. And whether it's in a private foundation, which also throws off fees and revenue, or whether it's just managing a large, multi-million-dollar portfolio, the advisors have an interest in having the pile continue to grow bigger and bigger. So that's again what makes Steph unique, and not unique. I keep meeting other advisors mm-hmm. who, like her, are kind of part of this awakening that there's a different path.
And this is different than investing in green issues and green corporations and that kind of a thing. This is actually about minimizing your wealth, reducing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the very ultra high net worth people I'm aware of who are kind of having these conversations are saying, yes, there's philanthropy, which is to give to support nonprofit, independent sector and great public radio stations and the like. Then there's impact investing. How do you move money to enterprises? So it's not charitable. They're for-profit enterprises, mm-hmm. but they may have, a social benefit. And then there's consumption. How do you consume money? And then there's this other network, the Patriotic Millionaires, which I also think is interesting because it's how do you use your voice, your status, if you will, to speak out publicly. And right now they're publicly saying, wealthy people should pay more taxes and philanthropy is not the answer. it does some things well, but it's not the whole game.
Let's see. Arnold in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Arnold.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Why don't we bring back the inheritance tax? It seems like it's the fairest tax. You're taxing people that are dead, and that it would generate an enormous amount of money with no real negative impact on the economy.
On the economy, but I guess the pocketbooks of the descendants, maybe. I don't know. That the inheritance tax and the abolishment of that in Ohio is relatively recent, Chuck Collins, which means it's probably unlikely they're going to turn around and switch it back.
True. And I recall it was also kind of a county by county basis. It's hard to imagine
right. The
state of Ohio. But I should say at the national level, we do have, you know, what's called the estate tax, which is sort of our national form of an inheritance tax. And it's become tremendously porous and weak. And that wealth defense industry spends a lot of time helping their wealthy clients sort of circumnavigate to the point where we had a Trump administration official say, you know, the estate tax, only morons pay the estate tax. Meaning that if you can pay for the advisors, you're not going to pay that tax. But I think Arnold is right. Having a robust inheritance tax, as it was originally conceived, you know, in 1916, really did slow that concentration of wealth and power. It did encourage philanthropy. It encouraged wealthy people to give money to charity, but it also was a way to raise revenue for public investments. So we need to have an uncontaminated discussion about, you know, how can we bring back taxes on extremely high fortunes to slow that democracy distorting concentration of wealth?
What do you mean about as far as how it was originally conceived in 1916?
Well, you know, really the estate tax came about because of rural populists, because people saw how politics was corrupted by big money, the robber baron fortunes. And you had, you know, with everyone from Teddy Roosevelt to Andrew Carnegie saying, you know, we should limit the dynastic accumulation of wealth. We're not England. We don't want to have, you know, inherited wealth dynasties and monarchs. We should limit, for democracy's sake, that accumulation of wealth and power. So that was the whole idea of the estate tax, was to slow that transfer. And it really did work, really, for 40, 50 years. It really did tax and break up big fortunes and led to investments in things that expanded opportunity for everybody else. So it served its original purpose quite well, but it's been under attack and weakened in recent decades.
Let's see, Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Arnold, by the way, thanks a lot for the call. Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, I'm just interested. This conversation is appalling to me. That we in the United States have allowed our politicians to be purchased wholeheartedly by the wealthy. And now the wealthy are deciding who's going to run for the Senate, who's going to run for governor, who's going to run for president. They, you know, politicians already are able to pick who's going to be who's going to vote for them. They don't pick a district because of the people that are there, other than if those people are voting for them. All this wealth has, and I don't see an answer to this, all this wealth has made it easier and easier for a handful of families to control what happens with our government and with our voting system. And as far as people not, you know, donating money so they don't have to pay any taxes, they're basically saying, we don't trust the government to do what's best for the people. And this is a government of the people, by the people, for the people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chuck Collins.
Well, Mike, you would fit in right with the debate that was happening 100 years ago, you know, about why we should have an inheritance tax, a wealth tax. And it was about democracy. It wasn't, you know, how do we raise money? You know, that was a secondary concern. It was how do we limit, put a brake on that concentration of wealth and power? And now we, as Mike so well described, we're living in a system where our democratic institutions have been captured by big money. And, you know, but Louis Brandeis actually back, you know, a century ago said, you know, you can have concentrated wealth in the hands of a few, or you can have democracy, but you can't have both. And I think the good news is people are waking up to that, and especially in the kind of post-pandemic world where it's so clear that, you know, it's kind of a heads I win, tails you lose economy for the wealthy. And there's a huge amount of profiteering and wealth kind of funneling to the top. And that's not, doesn't bode well for our democratic institutions. So separating the money and power from our political system is an absolute necessity.
I just saw a headline from the Washington Post. Poverty fell overall in 2020 due to massive stimulus checks and unemployment aid. That's according to the U.S. Census. I mean, it actually does get on the down. It gets down to a very granular level, making a difference.
No, I'm actually, interestingly, a lot of the pandemic emergency spending, support for low-income households, the expansion of the family tax credit, that has reduced childhood poverty in a year. You know, huge measures of, so, you know, defies the idea that together we can do big, meaningful things. We can use our tax dollars. It doesn't have to be, you know, all going to the Pentagon. We can use our tax dollars in ways that really make the economy work better for everybody, not just the very wealthy. That's hopeful.
You say that philanthropy is becoming more top heavy. What do you mean by that?
Well, as inequality has grown, the amount of giving by low and middle income people has been steadily going down. And almost all the growth in philanthropy is by the mega donors. So that has, you know, alarming and potential perils, which is, it means that the wealthy have a bigger say in how charity dollars go, what charities get supported, what causes receive money. It might affect the nonprofit sector as they kind of bend over backwards to kind of chase the bigger donors. It means that wealthy people, philanthropy becomes kind of an extension of their wealth and power and influence. So those are all reasons to be concerned about how more and more philanthropic dollars are, the decisions are made by fewer and fewer people.
Well, so what do you know about why giving is going down among middle class? I mean, it's part of an equation. It's not just that it's going up among wealthy as far as philanthropy goes.
Yeah, I mean, our research shows it correlates with rising economic insecurity, not just for the poor, but really for the bottom 60-70% of households. Home ownership rate going down, savings rates going down. Some of that's shifting during the pandemic, but you know, over the last 20 years, the number of households with like no financial reserves keeps growing. So I think it has to do with the fact that it's harder to give away to charity when you basically don't feel like your own economics house is in order. You know, you're feeling precarious, and that limits how much you can give.
I think it's so interesting, though, that over time we've seen time and time again how people, lower income people, give a higher percentage of their income, whatever and wherever that comes from, to charity.
Yeah, and one of the trends is that low and middle income people often will give without any tax benefit, by the way. They're not getting a tax break. They will give to the immediate needs in front of them, and often through religious congregations, but also, you know, Boys and Girls Clubs and local food banks. One of the patterns we should be concerned about is that wealthy people don't give directly to charity. They give to their own private foundations and donor advised funds in the hope that that money will eventually flow to the recipient charities. But what we're seeing is more and more warehousing of charitable funds in private foundations and donor advised funds. And we've been advocates of, you know, let's boost the payout rate. Let's increase the incentive to share, move the money to the charities sooner rather than later.
Chuck Collins, lots to think about. Thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Great conversation. Thank you, Anne.
Chuck Collins is director of the program on inequality and the common good. It's a progressive multi-issue think tank. His 2021 book is titled The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. He wrote about the process of letting go of wealth for the fall 2021 edition of Yes Magazine. We'll post a link to that at WOSU.org/All Sides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.